Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Martinson. Well, here in early 2016, volatility has returned to the markets with a vengeance. Perhaps like a beach ball held underwater, it has only inevitably returned because it's just long suppressed volatility doing what it does. But perhaps it's something more serious than that. Last week, markets were falling apart, but last night and this morning, they all shot higher, with the Japanese Nikkei climbing over 1,000 points from its lows on Friday after falling 11% last week. Last week, bad news was bad news, and this week, maybe bad news is good news because Chinese trade data was horrible. And that was good news for equity markets, at least for now. So how do we even begin to make sense of all this? Fortunately, returning to be with us today is one of my favorite people, Steen Jakobsen, Chief Investment Officer of Saxo Bank. He has many years of deep experience within the fields of proprietary trading, alternative investment. He travels widely, reads and writes constantly, and thinks very broadly about the world, where it's headed. Steen, it's a real pleasure to have you back with us today.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
The negative market sentiment hit a fever pitch last week. So was it overblown? Does today's market action suggest that risk on and buy the dip, or are they back?
It's a difficult one, of course, but clearly what we've seen over the course of the first quarter this year is that the ability of central banks to do their magic in terms of talking to the market, to have the rhetoric of low for longer and the likes is running on empty now. If we look back in sort of a chronicle order of what happened this year, first we had, of course, the Fed with Yellen and Fisher backing down slightly from the 3 to 4 hikes they promised in December. That was followed very quickly by, of course, Draghi promising to do whatever it takes again, yet again, in March of this year. And then BOJ went negative on interest rate, and a number of European central banks followed suit in terms of having dovish talk. So much so that actually right now, if you look at G7 government debt, about 50% of all G7 government debt is now trading at negative yield, which seems to be the new solution from central banks. And I think the market is seeing right through that because, of course, at the center of all this at all times will be the banking system, a banking system who are getting penalized for the negative interest rate. Coming from a country which has some experience with negative interest rates, what is really happening to the banking sector here is that the as a depositor, I get paid zero to have my money in the bank. I should, in reality, be paying 30, 40, 50 basis points. So far, I've been cushioned by the banks. That cushion is costing the banks money. And likewise, that is the reason why negative interest rate is not having any bearings in terms of improving things. So very dramatically last week, I made the headline that to some extent, in a monetary policy history, this could be the Berlin Wall coming down because we've had, you know, first the Bernanke put, then we had the Greenspan put, then the Bernanke put that doesn't exist, a Yellen put for a number of reasons, not because of her, but just because time has run out. So I think that explains the volatility, and it also explains the hope this week because oil is slightly higher, that drives the market higher. But at the end of the day, we are still, like the last conversation we had, it's still about pretend and extend. And the real question for an investor, in my opinion, is to ask yourself, is this merely the last extend and pretend, which is about to happen with Draghi coming full online in March and Bank BOJ doing another desperate action and the Fed backing down, or is it the end of the debt cycle? That is the $1 billion question right now.
And maybe a follow-up question to that billion-dollar question is this, have the central banks lost control?
Say that lost control would imply that they don't have any ability to move the market. So they lost control in the sense that they don't have a model that works. And I think to a large extent, people are, and we all have been victims of over dramatizing and focusing on central banks. I think it's kind of morally sad, at least, that central bankers are now bigger rock stars than prime ministers and presidents of countries. I mean, if you think about a central banker, it's a bureaucrat. It is a person who should be working behind the line, not in the front limelight. and it is a person who should be basing all the things on rule-based rules. Instead, they all with one voice now is saying, we don't really know what's going on, but we will continue to do what we do. If for no other reason, it's better than just having a non-rule-based system. So I don't think central bankers are bad economists. I just don't think they ever lived in the reality of a business. And you know as well as I do, Chris, business is about incentives, it's about tax structure, it's about having the smartest people around you, because there is a direct correlation between people's intelligence, the average intelligence of a company, or the average intelligence of a country. That equates totally to productivity. I think the R-square rule, R-square number is actually 72%. So, you know, we become dividend yield chasing investors and non-productive people.
What an important set of concepts you have in there, because as a businessman, I know it's, yes, you want the smartest people, it's intelligence counts, but so does experience. And what you just mentioned is, you know, I look at the FOMC, we went from one academic, came from Princeton, to another academic currently housed at Berkeley. We've got a couple of people with the right law degrees who are on all the right committees coming up through. We have nobody on the FOMC who's ever run a business, as far as I know. And so let's talk about these incentives. I have to confess, Dean, I am really confused by what is being attempted with negative interest rates, because if you carry it far enough, let's imagine Japan goes even further. Let's imagine we get to -2%. Let's imagine I can take a loan out at a negative interest rate. I'll do that all day long, Steen, but I'll take out a $10 million loan, earn $400,000 for not having done anything, and I won't do anything. I'll just sit around and collect my $400,000. I don't understand what the central bankers think they're doing, and my concern, and the question is, do we have people who are playing with something where they don't actually have the experience or the understanding of what they're really up to potentially?
Clearly, because you're never going to be able to take out a loan at negative interest rate. I will almost guarantee you that, Chris. Theoretically, in the world, the models they have at the Fed and the ECB and BOJ, it shouldn't matter whether interest rates are positive or negative. Don't forget, it's just an equation. It's put into a spreadsheet, and it actually has a zero impact on how it works in reality. The reality is, as we've seen in Denmark, that the banks have to cushion the depositors to keep them by not enforcing a negative interest rate. And I can tell you, being one of the first countries with negative interest, there's no one in Denmark that pays negative interest rate. What we instead do, and what will also happen to you if you ever go to that sort of lower boundary, is that the fees associated with banking goes up. So theoretically, I agree with you, you can probably borrow -1%, Chris, but I guarantee there will be all sorts of administrative fees that will make sure that your actual interest rate will be 1 or 2% after the fee. So it's purely a game of assuming in a model. And I think that's where the big divide is. At least before, when they had the ability to lower interest rate, we could see that that was feasible. But Chris, you cannot go deep negative interest rate for all the reasons you schedule. And on top of that, even if the model was right and you would be able to borrow -2%, as you say, it would just be another credit boom on top of the single biggest credit expansion in human mankind's history. I mean, McKinsey made a report recently where they stated that there's been $57 trillion worth of new debt since the great financial crisis started in 08, 09. Let's just say the number again, $57 trillion of new debt. Very little of the growth we see today is based on productivity, people being smart. It is very much based on the fact that we service debt. And the system is entirely dictated by a need to create liquidity. When you see the Chinese People's Bank of China selling bonds, U.S. bonds, to finance when they're devaluing the currency, is all to do with the fact that they want to create liquidity to service debt. So I saw a paper recently that stated that 75% of all liquidity creating by central banks is used to service in-place existing debt. So think about it. Only 25% of all that new credit that is created is actually being used to give it to you, Chris, as a business person. The rest has been used to keep in place the debt burden of a company, a country, a whole region like Europe.
That seems like such an obvious sort of a conclusion can be drawn from that, which is that there's diminishing marginal returns from credit expansion, but we don't know how to do anything else. And I saw that same McKinsey report, Steen, and what caught my eye was They said that in 2000, there was $87 trillion of debt outstanding. So in 2000, right? So all of human history up to 2000, we piled up $87 trillion. But between 2007 and 2014, that's where that additional $57 trillion went on. So that seven-year span accumulated pretty much three quarters of the amount of debt that had been accumulated in the prior 2,000 years, or whatever long we want to start recording it. That's an astonishing thing. So how much of the pressures that the financial markets are feeling is simply a function of too much debt?
Well, as we're still a low interest rate, the pain is not really there, despite all the volatility we've seen. And the other thing you have to remember, which is a paradox, if the numbers you just mentioned, if you divide that into the amount of assets in the world, you'll figure out there's actually four times more credit than there are assets. And most people will argue, well, for every dollar I have in savings, someone else will have a dis-saving, right? That, of course, is not true, because you have the banking system having a multiplier effect on the world economy. So we live in a world where for every one output dollar, we need four credit dollars. And that number, as you said, indirectly has been rising dramatically since the great financial crisis started. So the ability of society to deal with a high interest rate is one of the conclusions we need to take is zero. We hike the rates once and we have a Fed that maintains that they're going to hike further and the market is about to collapse. Imagine if rates actually went off for real, which, by the way, they have, which is the other part of this story. Policy rates remain low. Policy rates, as we economists call this, of course, is mainly central banks. But the actual rate you as a business people is confronted, a business person, Chris, is confronted with, of course, is ever higher. Look at the CCC junk bonds. If you look even at the AAA rates, all of these rates has been rising dramatically, and they come with a higher volatility. So not only is it more expensive to borrow money, but access in the money has also become more volatile, and then there's a tax on the ability to do it. So we have a sort of a very strange world where policy rates and the promises towards policy remains relatively low for longer still. But I think privately the central bank is, and certainly the market is, very skeptic about the ability of low for longer to actually feed through into a process. And one thing that has happened since you and I talked last year is the fact in academic circles, certainly among central banks, the new paper which people are sort of using as the anchor for the academic studies is a new paper which is done on Japan. And that paper argues, yes, you can have a trickle-down impact on the economy from lower rates for longer. But if it happens at the same time, simultaneous with a relatively restrictive fiscal environment, as you have in the U.S., as you have in Europe, and vice versa, the negative impact from a fiscal austere sort of budget, it's much bigger than the trickle-down effect. So, you know, they do know it both privately and academically, but to admit it is a totally different situation for central bankers.
Well, if they admit that, it feels a little like they're giving themselves an out, which is like, look, we did our part, but the fiscal side, those guys just forgot to deficit spend as much as they needed to. Is that true?
But isn't that interesting? Because what is the first thing that Yellen and Fisher and Draghi always said at a press conference? It is exactly that. They say monetary policy cannot stand on its own. It has to be supported by fiscal policy.
Yeah, well, but I thought, well, perhaps I need to study that paper, but my impression of Japan is that they've tried everything. Under Abe, have they not also had the fiscal policy there, and did not Japan just recently turn in very dismal readings on their economic growth? So Japan looks to me like, if we wanted to be honest about it, they're a large floating retirement colony. They're losing population. It's rapidly aging. They don't have the fuel demographically for robust expansion, but they still need to create it, not because the people of Japan need it, but the banking system needs constant credit expansion or it gets very unhappy. Is that a possible way to look at this?
It is, certainly. I mean, you to some extent is ending up with the balance sheet recession, which is, of course, Richard Kuhn or whatever economist is arguing. I'm just a pragmatic economist, as you know, Chris. Mm-hmm. The fact is that money doesn't flow, the incentive structure is wrong, and the policy tools at all obstacles will always be to extend and pretend, i.e. buying more time and service debt. And as long as we consume the gain, we will have massive rallies, we will have massive sell-offs, but we will not have a resolution that, sort of caters for a better, more productive future. But I think the beauty is that, we're so unproductive today. We're the least productive, we're the most stupid generation in history, according to academics' papers from the U.S. now. So, you know, it's the hope. It can't get much worse than it is right now in terms of our non-productiveness. And I think technology, I think evolution will take care of it. I think quantum computing will come online pretty soon inside the next 2 to 3 years. So I think there is a solution around the corner, but I also think we have this phase, the reality phase, the conversation you and I have, Chris, is, you know, both being very critical of where it comes from. But for every two of us, Chris, you'll find 90 people who thinks that, you know, monetary policy should be lower for longer and it actually works, and putting praise on the central bankers every day on CNBC. So, you know, we are a minority still. I mean, we will ultimately be right, but we may have to wait for a very long time before the clean out, the cleansing comes, the forest fire that cleans the deck comes through.
Well, certainly, because unfortunately, beliefs aren't changed with information. So I think we've got a very faith-based, belief-based system here. And that's why I was really asking, if the central bank's lost control, I'm really asking, to what extent is it starting to seep into the wider consciousness that there are actual real limits to what central banks can and cannot do, leaving aside their own human frailty, weakness, lack of experience, stuff like that. But that ultimately, you know, a small committee of appointed people is insufficient to really run a giant multifactorial complex system like an economy. I mean, come on. So when we look at that, you know, what I'm coming up on here is this idea that there has been a change in the wind, in the tenor of all of this, obviously. I think there's central banks are not out of bullets by any stretch. They've done things that are pretty amazing, but I think they could do more. But it sounds like you're saying under all of this that there's a crisis coming and that might be good for us.
Yeah, it's very good. I believe in forest fire. Isn't it the sycamore tree? They figured out it was about to be extinct. And they figured out the reason why that you in the U.S. did the you had the Forest Service that stopped all the forest fires. Mm-hmm. Yep. So the sycamore tree is a good sort of analogy to the markets. We need the forest fire. We need the, you know, to create new light and cleaning up the mess in the underforest. And it may sound very traditional, it may sound very Schumpeterish, but the fact of the matter is, if you don't allow the business cycle to run, you will have artificial non-performing loans, as we just came from. You will have a steering rate, a policy rate, artificially low. You will have valuations, which is based on Excel spreadsheet, where when you multiply with a number very close to zero, you get infinity. And that's not reality. Reality is if you have to pay for higher wages to your employees, it has to be based on productivity. You're not against paying higher salaries. You're just against it as long as they're non-productive. All the basic rules of economics doesn't apply anymore at zero bound or at very close to zero. On top of that, you know, 90% of what happens in the media and the reporting, even my very esteemed fellow economists, 90% of what they say is simply not true. I mean, there's so little fact-based analysis going on. There's so little scientific approach to analyzing things. The only thing you constantly hear in terms of monetary policy, yeah, but Steen, you know, hadn't they done that, we'd be in a worse situation. And I go like, okay, first of all, how do we know that? I mean, you know, I can't prove a positive negative, right? So it's I think the whole science of markets, the whole science of politics, I think that is dramatically changed. And not only is it a forest fire, I think it's a true and coon sort of traditional sense of a paradigm shift. It's a paradigm shift we stand in front of, because I think we're going to go back to far more practicality. I think central bankers of the future will be people who come partly from the business cycle, partly from academia. So you have that, you know, common ground of trying to do and do the least amount of damage to the economy. I mean, instead, they're trying to have the highest impact on the economy in terms of persuading you and me things are fine. They should have the opposite goal, which is to do as little as possible to unsettle the market-based interest rate, the market-based incentive rule. But of course, they're being failed miserably by the worst crop of politician ever. Just look at the selection for the American president. If that's not the worst selection ever in history, I don't know what is.
Well, sometimes you get the leadership you deserve. So there's a little, you can engage in some schadenfreude from across the sea if you want.
Listen, Chris, this is not just a U.S. phenomenon. This is a global phenomenon. So I could do the same in France with Marie Le Pen. I could do the same in Denmark with what is called the Danish Folkparti. I could do it in Sweden. I could do it in the U.K. There is a version of Trump or Sanders in every single country right now. And then I think the fact that we can find the similar characters in every economy also shows you sociology-wise, the social fabric is about to give up. I mean, don't forget, you and I talk about this like it's like the most important thing in life. Meanwhile, less than 5% of Americans care about what we talk about. Less than 3% understand what we talk about. I mean, I saw one of the U.S. Today had a number, the economic illiteracy in the U.S. is 80%.
Yeah.
Chris, so also, why is it important? I mean, I also think we need to let people understand that an economy is a good thing. And just a final point, sorry for talking so much, but you talked about the multi-factor model. You know, I've been doing this for close to 30 years. What I realized is, what I realized after all these years is, I know nothing about the black box called the economy or the markets. What I can observe, however, it's what we put into the black box and what comes out of the black box. So what goes into the black box, of course, is the cost of capital, which I think is the far most important input factor in anything you do in life, and the cost of union labor costs, because, you know, everything being equal, human beings are part of the process in a lot of numbers. And the output is profit and productivity. And if you observe those four factors, which I think is most important, when the cost of capital is going up, the union labor costs are certainly going up in the U.S., number of jobs is relative to population unchanged, and the profitability in EBITDA terms, so free cash flow terms, are and has been negative for the last 18 months. That's not a recipe for high valuation of stock markets. Yes, the people want to believe the low interest rate can guarantee it, but there is an economic gravity. So instead of trying to understand the black box called the economy and the market, I think we look at the input and the output factors, both set of data exactly supporting that we have a correction in the marketplace.
Well, absolutely. And part of what happened inside that black box with all those incentives that you mentioned on the input side was CFOs came to the very rational conclusion that if they could borrow at 1% and retire stock yielding 2% and goose their share price in the interim with buybacks, that all made perfect sense. But in the meantime, you know, where have been the productive pieces that are going to lay the fertilizer for the next stage of growth in that forest? So if we go back to that forest fire analogy, I got to ask you, particularly about the European banks banking system. Look, we've all seen the drubbing that Deutsche Bank's shares have taken, but there's much more widespread weakness in a lot of bank shares across Europe at this point in time. My concern is that a little forest fire, which would have been great, I think, to have had a number of years ago, may be a crown fire at this point. Am I reading too much into what's going on? I really don't have any insight into what's happening at Deutsche Bank or why, but I'm hoping you can shed some light there.
Well, I'm no expert on Deutsche Bank, but I think if you look at the too big to fail European banks and that universe, it's very clear that they have the capital structure is much stronger than it was in 08, 09 for sure. But there is a number of unaddressed issues, which is, of course, the legacy costs from the FX scandal, the Lipofan scandals and the likes. And of course, the U.S. Department of Justice is always on the heels of these guys. That's number one. And I think a number of these organizations has been very slow to adapt to a new world. And I think that the next phase will be that a number of major names you've been used to seeing in the U.S., they will close down totally in the U.S., partly because of regulation, partly because of the fines, and partly because they never, ever actually made money in North America. And I think the risk and the penalizing of European banks that happened throughout the early part of this year is the fact that people look at the input factors and the output factors. So think about it, Chris. If you run a bank and the cost of capital is rising, could be partly good for banks. Union labor cost is rising is also partly good because it increases the disposable income. But lower profit and organizations means lower bonuses and probably again lower salaries and lower growth overall. So lower top line growth with the two great growth engines of the world being China and the U.S., both of them operating at two-thirds of what is their maximum capacity. U.S. is barely making 2%, and China is barely making 6% these days. So they come, China come from 9-10, U.S. comes from 3 and change. So top line is lower, cost of capital will reduce the profitability of the companies, higher unit labor costs will reduce the corporation's earnings, everything equal, less tax receipt, less tax people. That's why the banks are under pressure in Europe, because we come from a lower lower rate of growth. Having said that, I think the gap between the U.S. and Europe will almost close entirely over the next 12 to 15 months. Number one, because Europe is having the single biggest impact from low energy prices over time, being net energy importers. Secondly, because the refugee situation, whether you whatever you believe politically about that, right or wrong, you have to remember this is exactly the fiscal impulse we talked about before, which was impossible to institute under normal rules. But now you have, you know, refugees who is getting, you know, Sarah is getting money to spend to buy coaches and education, infrastructure investment will increase significantly. I mean, Germany has 1 million people more now driving on the U-Bahn, on the freeways and the like. So Europe is going to close the gap on the U.S. in that respect. So you can argue that end of the day, the banking system, as you say, is entirely dependent on whether we get a forest fire. And if it happens, I think European banks are just as bad or just as poor as investment as American banks will be. For now, the market seems, in my opinion, artificially, that the U.S. banks are stronger. But having said that, who has the biggest debt mountain in the world? U.S. consumers, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, absolutely. So, excuse me, let me ask specifically then about Italian banks. You know, I was a bit floored reading in Financial Times that 18% non-performing loans, maybe another 15, 16% of marginally performing loans. But the 18% alone, isn't a banking system insolvent when it gets to a level of non-performing loans that are, I don't know, over the reserve ratio plus capital? I mean, is there any way to look at the Italian banks besides systemically insolvent at this point?
See, that's interesting. It's two different business models. And of course, your conclusion from a balance sheet, if everything has to be liquidated, wouldn't be wrong. But you have to remember a bank is a going concern as long as they have more deposit than they have outflows, right? So, and that's what makes a bank very different from any other companies. If you ran a company according to the Italian banks rules, you would have been closed a long time ago, Chris. But the fact is that as you have a central bank and ECB supporting them, they will have access to liquidity. And banks only die from illiquidity. They don't buy from bad loans. That get restructured, it gets, you know, delayed, it gets, you know, sold off in buckets of risk, whatever. So the issue with Italy, in my opinion, is not even the non-performing loan. It is the fact that about 80% of all government bonds in Italy is owned by pensioners and is issued U.S. corporate paper indirectly through the banks, or banks the other way around, right? So you have an interdependency where by virtue of this interdependency, we have more risk to the sovereign risk of Italy than we had before the crisis, because what's happened ever since is that Italian banks has been buying BTBs, the Italian bond market, and they've been selling it to the pensioners and the savers of Italy. So they're all independent on the Italian bond market surviving into a world, as you say, with I think there's about €400 billion so worth of non-performing loans. The Italian economy, of course, is much, much bigger, but they are, like everyone else, coming back to the argument we keep having here, or the conclusion we keep having. So Italy needs to service the debt. Why do we do that? You create more liquidity, ECB goes deeper into negative, and we are on to another game of pretend and extend.
Mm. So it can wash, rinse, repeat. Here we are. Well, last year when you were with us, you said that 2015 would turn out to be a lost year. I think you nailed that one. What do you say about 2016 then?
I think that 2016 will be slightly different. I think it will be a year of two halves. I think the first half is always going to be very nasty due to what we discussed. But I think either we go that deep and get the correction and the paradigm force forward in a mini, or we get some desperate policy fiscal tool, a global plan for infrastructure investments. Don't forget, we run a deficit of about $3 trillion worth of infrastructure investment every year, which means that if we don't invest the $3 trillion, we're actually getting a capital stock, which is deteriorating, which can be seen in any U.S. airport, by the way, or New York Metro. It hasn't been renewed in 100 years. So I do believe there is, you know, I think by the end of the year, you and I will be laughing at this year, and there will be good things coming out of this year, unlike last year. But right now, the market is very, very, very focused on the path of Fed Reserve. And the market can only focus on one thing at a time. First, it was China. I never believed that China would be a real issue. Is China having problems? Absolutely. Is it in the magnitude of upsetting the world, like most American economies and fund managers think? I don't think so. I think China is not a slow, it's not a hard landing. It's not a soft landing. I think it's a long landing. It takes a long time, and we don't really understand with balance sheet approaches to what goes on. So it's China, it's oil, and it's Fed. And, you know, oil probably would need to trade 2022 before this route is over, and they get desperate enough to have a real solution from OPEC. In terms of the global growth engine, both China and U.S. will be slow into the half year. And certainly China will, you know, they constantly are lowering the cost of capital. They're trying to get things rebalanced. So maybe China can be the surprise at the end of the year. So we need two things this year to make it an okay year, a weaker dollar, and China to be doing better than most fund managers in the U.S. seems to think they can do.
Yeah, that's a big open question. I wish I had more insight into China. You know, peering from the outside, just looking at their growth in bank assets from 2007 to current, it's certainly one of the more aggressive, if not frightening, sort of accumulations. It's hard for me to imagine that they got $20 trillion of new loans out the window and they were all good loans to make. I think that's hard to do, given the magnitude of that compared to their economy. So, yeah, obvious open question. We'll see how they play that, but they've got different tools, I guess, than as a command and control economy than we would have. So yeah, we'll see how that plays out. But so much sort of hinges on this idea of global growth. Recession indicators, you know, they're all over the map. Where do you stand on the chance of a global recession this year?
I think mathematically it's at whatever 15-20% likelihood, which means that 80-85% probability it won't happen. But you know, recession is just a technical term. Low growth, deflation is reality. And the U.S., ever since the Great Financial Crisis, has not managed to have a single year above 2.25%. So we are in a low growth environment, irrespectively, and that feels like a recession to wage earners, to Main Street, to small business people, and to central banks because they continue to be desperate. So I don't really think it matters where we go into a recession. The fact is that we are not moving away from a low interest rate deflationary environment. And that's probably where I differ with most people. I think second half of this year we will have a reversal of many of these trends. I think the low in inflation is coming in as we speak because there are, you know, core inflation remains relatively elevated, certainly relative to five-year forwards and the likes of inflation in projectors. So I think overall, Chris, there's no reason to be desperate here or go in panic mode, but we just moved from an extremely overvalued stock market to a expensive stock market. Mm-hmm. Whether it stops here and then reverses, I of course don't know, but I do expect that we will go to sort of fair value to slightly cheap. But having said that, you know, where would you want to put your money for the next 20 years? With a CEO who wants to make profit or with the U.S. government or Draghi? Yeah, offering you negative interest rate, I don't think it's something that works. So to some extent, whether we believe in it or not, as long as we have this negative interest rate environment, we need to be investing in equity, and inside equity, we need to be investing, in my opinion, and I think you agree with that, in stocks which are productive. So I think the very question you need to ask yourself right now in terms of technology and where to be in the market in stocks is to ask yourself, the product I buy, does that have a productivity component for two reasons. Number one, because that is the, you know, survival of the product long term, which is at play. And if you are productive, by the way, you cannot be you cannot be abrupted by another business model. As long as you're productive, the concept, of course, is that you have a moderate return on your capital, which is positive. So I think the rules are changing. It may look the same, but I think the rules are changing dramatically, and the only people investing in productivity in every single shape and form they can find will be rewarded over the next 2 to 3 years. But I do think there are a huge amount of opportunities to be had away from supporting governments and their bonds.
How do you go about finding a company with good productivity? Are you scouring the financial statements, or is there some other process here?
Both bottom up and top down. Of course, you look for I mean, early innovators are not necessarily the best. Look at Apple. I don't think Apple has led in anything but design in technology, but they still maintained, you know, the highest margin ever in history. But for productivity terms, I look at companies which are, you know, truly entrenched in the whole sort of business model of trying to save money for the users. Take a Honeywell, who is the world's controlling company in terms of doing intelligent houses, smart houses, whatever. So I think all of these things we need to do more work on. Until now, we've just been buying Apple because we like the product. So we've been invested with our heart, if I can say so. Now you need to be doing it with your mind. But for me, the standout sort of sectors to look at remains mining and to some extent the energy sector, because I think I even touched on it last year. I think that's where the fundamental value is. You know, all these companies are now priced to failure, and I do believe the dollar. I think the weaker dollar will lead to stabilization of the commodity market, and ultimately I think oil will move back to whatever range of $30, $50, $40, $50 on average for the next 10 years. So I think the world is about, and I think the world is being forced into a new recalibration and resetting of global fundamental value. In that process, not names in, you know, the unicorns of alike are getting overpriced, and manufacturing productive companies at the other end is being mispriced. So for me, that's where I'm looking, Chris. I'm long the GDX index for a while. I like gold for the first time in a long time. I know you like gold always, Chris. Yeah, but I'm with you for once. But I'm rather by the mines right now than anything else, because I think, you know, lower energy cost is helping the mine productivity. They're reducing capex, which is going to create a diminished supply. So I'm looking for tangible assets, to be honest, Chris, and companies that delivers to the tangible assets. Infrastructure investment, and I think infrastructure investment is going to be huge. Any company involved in infrastructure over the next 10 years is going to make a lot of money.
That makes sense, particularly if that fiscal meme gets picked up, we talked about. So last question, then. You mentioned you think oil maybe goes lower. I'm of the oil at this price is destroying capital for everybody in the shale space. I don't believe for a minute any of these so-called analyses that say they make money at 30. That's true only if you cherry pick wells, but across the average of the entire plays, it's a very simple calculation to run. You only have so much oil coming out of these wells. They cost so much to drill. Your capital costs this. It's easy. By my calculations, you need $50 to $60 oil to make money. Anything under that, you're burning money. I know that there's a bottom coming in oil at some point, but my argument here is that oil has to go to the marginal cost of production, and shale is a marginal cost producing area. So I think we have to get to at least the break even for those plays. So I'm really looking for oil to rebound. I just don't know when yet, because the supply overhang is really quite severe at this point. But we're only one OPEC decision away from that being reversed. So is it too early in your mind to begin nibbling at this?
No. I'm with you, Chris. I just think when I say it has to go lower, I'm really saying, look, just technically, I think 2022 would be perfect. But as you know, for the profitability of the industry and for the input to the economy in terms of energy costs, it is the average price for the year. And like you, I'm very, very, very confident that we will move to the marginal cost of production inside this year and probably hit that as an average price for the year. Of course, OPEC can one-off set the prices higher, but as having been someone who lived through the 1970s and when OPEC really was in force, it doesn't work long time as long. But the fact is, Iran's supply is overstated. The dramatic drop in U.S. ability is not priced correctly. So I'm with you, Chris. We are moving to a average price of $50 for the next 10 years and probably going slightly higher, because last time I checked, the earth was round and we don't get any new sort of land territory involved with us. So, I'm with you. And actually, one of our outrageous calls this year is all to $100.
Very good. So, yeah, I'm with you. Also, the earth is round. I checked yesterday. It was still round. So, hey, thank you so much for your time today. What's that?
Your telescope, I said.
Yeah, these satellites going around. It's amazing. So, thank you so much for your time today, Steen. I follow you at tradingfloor.com. Is there anywhere else people can and should find and follow your work?
No, that's the perfect place. They put out most of my research. And if anyone of your listeners you want to be on the direct email list, if it's not too much inconvenience, just write to you guys or send it on to me or do it on Trading Floor where people can find my name. I'm very willing to share the private stuff I do.
Fantastic. Well, thank you. I receive those. They're just wonderful updates. I really appreciate the way you look at the world and also for taking your time to talk with me today.
Chris, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, and thanks very much for you and your team for having me on.